Hello, once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today on Medical Monday to answer your questions, and you're going to want to get on the phones fast because they're all going to be in use in a second, is to answer your questions about radiology and related issues, is Dr. Gary Siskin, professor and chair of radiology at Albany Medical Center. A graduate of the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York, he completed his residency in radiology at Kings County Hospital Center in Brooklyn, New York. Also in practice with community care physicians, Dr. Siskin is a certified diplomate of the American Board of Radiology, through which he also has a certificate of added qualification in vascular and interventional radiology. Dr. Siskin, welcome to the Vox Pop.
Thank you, Alan.
So glad you're here. Give us a call, everyone, 1-800-348-2551. Or you can post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wmc.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WMC Radio. And, of course, always, you can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. Okay, so here we go. Let's talk about it. Dr. Siskin, first of all, congratulations on how far you've come and all the things you've done.
Well, thank you very much.
Appreciate it very much. Let's talk for a moment about what's new and what's hot, and as Jerry Lee Lewis always used to sing, and what's not. You guys are doing a lot more than you used to do.
Well, we are. I think one of the reasons why is because technology has gotten so good. It used to be a couple of decades ago that we had an X-ray camera and pretty much that was it. So any picture we needed to take of the body was a simple X-ray. Today you have MRIs and CAT scans and ultrasounds and PET scans and just a variety of other tests that make it almost impossible for almost every doctor out there to proceed with the care of a patient without getting radiology's help.
I know that you're doing some fascinating work on uterine tumors.
We are. Actually, uterine fibroid tumors, which are benign tumors of the uterus, have been a problem plaguing women for decades.
A lot of people have had them. Yep.
That's right. It's actually one of the most common reasons for women to have hysterectomies. Yeah. And so there's been a lot of searches over the past couple of years to look for a non-surgical treatment for fibroids. Actually, up here at Albany Med, we're one of the leading centers in the country performing a procedure called uterine fibroid embolization, where we can actually go inside the arteries bringing blood to fibroid tumors and plug them up in order to kill them. And what that does is it shrinks them and reduces the symptoms that these women are experiencing.
Let me get that straight, because I was a little confused there. You bring blood to the tumor, right?
Yep.
And that, because the blood comes to the tumor, it, quote, plugs it up? I don't get it.
No, what we're doing is the tumor relies on the blood supply that the body is bringing to it.
Right.
So in other words, blood is making its way to the fibroid tumor, and essentially that's what's keeping the tumor alive. We can actually go inside the blood vessels with little tiny catheters.
I saw that. That's what your added degree is in. Going inside those blood vessels.
That's right. So it's going inside the blood vessels and injecting things into those arteries that the tumors don't like, and that's how we can treat them.
Now, recently, I heard an underwriting ad for non-invasive surgery, robotics. How does robotics play with your field of radiology?
Well, robotics are a little different. That's more of a surgical area. So
sure.
What that's doing is it's providing surgeons with an extension to their hands that enables them to manipulate equipment and do surgery without actually putting their hands into the patient.
Yeah, but they still have to know what's there before they go in.
They still have to know what's there, but they're using different types of cameras.
Yeah.
For us, we're using our X-ray cameras to guide the procedures that we do on patients.
Okay, let's go to Warren in Albany. Warren, you're on.
Good afternoon. I have a question that related to your field. I have a couple of kids who are heading towards college and finishing high school, and we'd like to send them in directions of, you know, medical technology. Where would one find out about? I mean, you have such a diverse field from, you know, sonograms and MRIs and all kinds of films that you get to use. How would you direct somebody who's not going to go for 12 and 16 years of education into that area?
It's a great question. I mean, certainly, as you mentioned, the 12 to 16 years is kind of reserved more for the doctor end of things. But radiology requires an enormous support staff to make it work every day. And fortunately, actually, in our area, Hudson Valley has a terrific educational program for technologists and sonographers. So the people who are actually taking the x-rays and preparing the x-rays for interpretation and actually obtaining the ultrasound images or the mammograms or any of the other type of images that I mentioned, that requires specialized training as well, but certainly not for the decade that you mentioned when it comes to a doctor.
Do they pay well?
They actually pay very well. I mean, they're definitely on the positive side of the average for salaries in this area.
Okay. And the other question is when, you know, in the old days, you guys used to be at some risk, used to wear badges, and if you were going to be – is that true still, including these people who are taking these pictures for you?
Well, a lot of the actual picture taking is done remotely, so there's a lot less exposure to the – people in taking the pictures than there is to the patient in the room. So certainly for someone who takes x-rays, they're always usually out of the room when the x-ray is actually being obtained. So there's less risk, but I can't say it's zero.
Is it? There are people who have been saying for years, you go to the dentist, now they're covering you up in places and parts that they never used to, over your thyroid and over your, mm-hmm. bottom parts. Have we become more cognizant of the potential danger of radiation to patients?
Absolutely. I mean, for tests like regular x-rays and CAT scans, those are the two tests that we worry most about because they actually deliver radiation to patients. Mm-hmm. So we always have to CAT scan delivers more than an x-ray. That's right. And so what we worry about is that the amount of radiation that we're giving is actually going to cause a problem as opposed to contributing to solving a problem for a patient. The good news is that the risk of most of the x-ray exams that we do is such a small incremental risk than the risk that's just present through everyday life that it really doesn't substitute for the information that we need to obtain for your physician.
So how much remediation is now done by x-ray? In other words, we know that x-ray has been always used as diagnostically, but does it? But more and more we're seeing x-ray being used. And by the way, I'm going to let you go, Warren. Yep. Okay. Thank you. More and more we're seeing x-ray being used to solve problems.
Well, I think we're seeing a field that actually used to be part of radiology, but is now a separate field called radiation oncology. So there's a whole host of uses for radiation to treat cancers out there.
And what do you do?
Well, I mean, it actually isn't my field, but certainly some colleagues at the medical center and at other institutions around, there are people who will direct higher sources of radiation therapy towards cancers and other parts of the body that are plagued by those conditions. And the radiation will actually kill the tumors in such a way that hopefully will, help out the patient and cure the problem.
So first you'll find it, and then they'll do their thing.
First you got to find it, then you got to treat it.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Jay in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Jay, you're on.
I was curious if you can take x-rays of the brain and use those to diagnose mental illness.
Mental illness. Interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I think it's a two-part answer to that question. The first part is that sometimes people who have symptoms that may be interpreted as a mental illness may in fact be due to other conditions that are going on inside the brain. Mm-hmm. So we take pictures of the brain using CAT scans or MRIs to make sure that none of those other conditions exist. Now, there's also some new advanced imaging. There's things called functional imaging that could potentially show different parts of the brain that aren't working correctly, and that could lead to symptoms as well.
Anything else on that, Jay?
No, that's it. Thank you.
You're welcome. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll take a very short break. I mean 7-8 seconds, and we will be right back. And by that time, you really ought to be on the phone if you've got a question, any question about radiation.
Support for WAMC comes from Anderson Center for Autism, Statsburg, New York, providing educational and residential programs, diagnosis, and treatments for children and adults. AndersonCenterForAutism.org. Friends of Chamber Music presenting Tokyo String Quartet Farewell Tour Sunday, February 17th at 3 p.m. in the Kiggins Hall at Emma Willard School in Troy, New York. 518-273-4843 for tickets. and Avonlea Inn, Jewel of the Sea, Block Island, Rhode Island, a bed and breakfast offering room options, full hot breakfast, central cooling and heating, located on the beach and in downtown. BlockIslandInns.com.
Well, my friends, we have four phones ringing for Dr. Siskin, as you probably know. A brilliant man, the head of things radiological at the Albany Medical College, and a graduate where's my brain? Maybe you better take a picture of it. Your medical education was at?
It started at Mount Sinai for medical school.
One of the best in the country, yeah.
And then stayed around the New York City area and did some training at NYU, Kings County, and Columbia Presbyterian.
Great. Okay, let's go to Raoul in Holyoke, Massachusetts. Okay, Raoul, you're on.
Hi, how's it going? I'm calling because I work with a lot of students who are going from high school to college, and some are not prepared to jump into a four-year school, and we try to recommend... Sorry about that. We try to recommend that they get into two-year programs that can then lead to a job right after the program. And one of the ones we always talk about is the radiology tech program at the local community college. And a question that comes up regularly is the amount of exposure that, you know, radiology tech folks get when they're working and whether or not it's a decision they should make for their health if they're looking at this as something that they want to do for an entire career.
Well, we did touch on that briefly before, but sure. What I can tell you is that these days, most of the images that are taken of patients by the technologists are taken with the technologists outside the room. So they're not getting the same degree of exposure that a patient might get when they're going through a CAT scan or an X-ray. So I would say that while it's not zero, it's certainly not exposure that's dangerous to their health. And just as importantly, any employee working in a radiology department is constantly being monitored from the amount of exposure that they're getting. So if for some reason there was a problem and they were getting too much exposure, it would be recognized very quickly.
And how do you do that? Through badges? Or how do you,
We do. Everybody working in the radiology department wears a badge that's analyzed monthly.
Yeah, great. Raoul, anything else?
No, that was it. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are excellent. Let's go to Nay in Liberty, New York. Okay, Nay.
Yes, hi. My name is Nye.
I'm so sorry.
You... No problem. I'm just calling you because I had surgery, and it was for a subarachnoid hemorrhage.
Mm-hmm.
And so they told me that from now on I can no longer have MRIs. And so I called to make an appointment. They said I had to have an MRA. I called to have make an appointment, and the people with the radiology said it's the same machine, so we need to know exactly what's going on in your head.
Right. So I will tell you that the reason why they're worried about it is that when you go into an MRI scanner, it's a magnetic field. And certainly you know that if you hold up metal near a magnet, the metal can move towards the magnet. So we worry about that. So depending on the type of equipment that they use during surgery and maybe some of the things they left inside you, it may in fact make an MRI dangerous. But here, two things you need to know. The first is that these days, and I don't know when you had your surgery, but these days most of the equipment that's used is MRI compatible. So certainly,
I had the surgery in June.
So I certainly would think that most of the equipment that they used is MRI compatible, but the hospital where you had your surgery should know that. So if the need for the MRI is really important, it would certainly be worth it for you or your doctors to find out everything that was left inside you. And then, believe me, we have big books of equipment lists in the MRI scanners to know what's safe and what's not.
Now, Nye also mentioned the other issue here, which is an MRA as opposed to an MRI. What's that?
Well, sure. What they both are, they're both MRI tests, meaning you go into the MRI scanner,
which
does not use radiation, uses a different way to take pictures. But the difference is that an MRA, it's defined as a magnetic resonance angiogram, and an angiogram means it's a picture of blood vessels. So that's an MRI test specifically designed to look at the blood vessels of the brain. An MRI in general is really more of a general picture of the brain, certainly in this particular case, but anywhere in the body like the knee, the shoulder, and other common places where MRIs are used.
Well, to put it in lay terms, is an MRA as good as an MRI?
Yeah, it's really just the same thing, just taking a picture of a different part of the body.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it. Very helpful.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. Again, 1-800-348-2551. We got two free phones. Let's go to Maria in Olive Bridge. Hi, Maria.
Hi. I guess the general subject is, and I apologize if I'm repeating anything that was already said because I just tuned in a few minutes ago.
Don't worry about it.
Okay. What are the risks to an ill person, a person already ill, to radiation exposure? Now, I know that's a very broad question, and of course it would vary depending on the person, blah, 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 but I was taking care of my elderly parents a number of years ago, and when I looked up various kinds of cancer, as I started looking more and more, radiation exposure was on the short list of every single type of cancer. And so I understand it's a low level of radiation, but I wonder if you could address that a little bit.
Okay.
Because I'm always nervous about, like, I fell and...
Maria, that's a great question. We're going to get it answered for you. Go ahead, Doc.
Maria, the biggest risk that we worry about when it comes to being exposed to radiation in association with these X-ray exams is the risk of getting a cancer down the road in the future at some point. What you need to know is that walking around, all of us have a risk of cancer just from just routine risk and just exposure to just background radiation that's occurring normally as part of living on Earth. So what we do is we look at how much extra radiation someone's being exposed to as part of getting a CAT scan or an X-ray. And what we know is that it only adds to the risk of getting one of those cancers very, very slightly. So while it's not zero, it's not necessarily something to avoid if the health problem demands that one of these exams be performed.
Put another way, if we do that, and I was wondering about this as you were speaking, Doctor, if we have global warming and we have the ozone layer and we have the rest of it, is our exposure increased?
Possibly. Yeah, I think that's one of the dangers of what's happening from a climate perspective.
Mm-hmm. Maria, anything else?
Yes. If you were, let's say you had a problem, I don't right now, but in the future, who knows, what tests would give the least amount of radiation exposure? I know MRI is electromagnetic radiation, which, of course, is not radiation in the way we understand it, us lay people, but... I don't know, if you had a choice of different tests, which one would be the least?
Michelle, the question is, does one have a choice? I mean, CAT scans are used for different reasons than MRIs are, aren't they?
That's right. I was going to jump on that point as well.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. The fact is that if you have a medical condition that requires you being evaluated by one of these tests, the question really first is, what's the best test for you to have? Because I think what you don't want to do is have three or four different tests. So you should always go for the test that's going to answer the question as definitively as possible. If that happens to be a CAT scan, which is associated with the most radiation, then you're still better off getting that one CAT scan to answer the question that you have. Now, everything in moderation is what I say. So getting one CAT scan is not a problem. Getting a CAT scan every month for 2 or 3 years, that's when you have a problem.
Okay, but just to keep it short and simple, CAT scans are used for and MRIs are used for.
Well, it's not as clean as I think you'd want it to be.
Yes.
So I think that ultimately there are some conditions where MRIs are great. In a lot of times, conditions that involve the brain or the spine really can be solved or the questions can be answered with the use of an MRI. A lot of times if it's a problem involving the abdomen or the pelvis, then a lot of times CAT scans are really the better way to go.
Why?
Same thing with the lungs, primarily because of the way the pictures are taken. So when you have bowel that can move inside your abdomen or the lungs are constantly expanding and constricting as you breathe, that can really get in the way of good MRI pictures. And so a CAT scan is oftentimes better for those areas of the body.
Do we call that soft tissue as opposed to hard tissue?
Well, yeah, of course it's soft tissue if it's not bone. But I guess what I'm saying is that in general, I think a way to look at it is conditions that involve the joints, the spine, and the head are probably better answered with an MRI.
Right.
And conditions that involve the chest, abdomen, and pelvis are probably today solved largely or answered largely with CAT scans, although MRI is having an increasing role in those areas.
Thank you. Hey, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Liz in Altamont, and I just want to give one instruction to our wonderful new phone answerer. We never take down the last one and do her off the phone with them. Okay, Liz, go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Siskin. I had a uterine embolization in 1999. So I still have my uterus, and the fibroids have calcified. I just was wondering down the line here now, what kind of interests or concerns should I have about having them? Because, for example, you know, regular appointments with a gynecologist is one thing, but they don't necessarily have the information to deal with this. So that would be my question to you.
So let me add to that pregnancy and the rest of it. Could you address that?
Sure. Well, let me get to Liz's question first, if that's okay. So after, you know, 13 or 14 years after having a fibroid embolization, when you mention that your fibroids are calcified, that's really a normal response that we would expect to see.
True, and I was told that,
after a procedure like this. So if you take a step back and let's ask the question, what happens to fibroids in women who don't do anything? Well, in that case, what happens once these women enter menopause, meaning their ovaries stop working and they no longer have normal cycles, well, at that point, the fibroids go through a dying process and become essentially scar tissue within the uterus, and that leads to the calcifications that you mentioned. So all the procedure does is accelerate that normal process. So the fact that you have calcified fibroids in your uterus, as long as they're not bothering you in any way, then there's really no issue at all to having them there.
And the foam gel and the pellets that were used, now, they're still in the arteries?
Well,
what ended up happening to that?
Your body recognized that those particles aren't really meant to be there. So what it does is it sends certain cells into the area to really clean up that area and really isolate those particles from the rest of your body. So at this point right now, based on the knowledge that we have, they're safe and won't cause you any problems.
So if you don't have
to... are they still inside the artery, or did the artery disintegrate and then be replaced with these, you know, a cell formation?
No, they're not disintegrated per se, but they've been isolated and changed in such a way that they're not going to distribute anywhere else in the body. I think if you took out the uterus and looked at it under a microscope, you might see evidence of those particles having been there, but they're not going to look the same as they were when they were put inside you.
Because they really only just went into the arteries that actually are part of that organ.
That's right. That's correct.
And then the calcification.
They don't go anywhere else in the body. That's right.
So, and then, and is there any special precaution, though? There's no special precaution if one ends up having a hysterectomy?
No, nothing at all. You do not need to do anything different, and your doctor doesn't need to do anything differently.
No, the hysterectomy, for those naive people like me, is the removal of the uterus.
Is
that right? Okay, so what's the advantage of keeping the uterus? Can you get pregnant? I mean, what happens?
Well, I think after a procedure like this, what we know is that people can get pregnant if they want to get pregnant. So in other words, one should not confuse this procedure as birth control. But the fact is that we tend to offer other options for people who know that they're going to want to have a baby. So we always talk about some surgical options, which have a bit more history to them and a bit more research behind it in terms of the safety of having children. But with that said, I know from my own experience and the experience around the country that women who have this procedure and want to get pregnant are able to do that.
Okay, Liz, thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much.
Can I just have one more follow-up question?
Of course, go ahead.
If one does do the hysterectomy, in the intervening years, it's and Alan has even had Dr. I think Dropkin on, who talked about how the ovaries now they're seeing. Okay, so my ovaries that were affected by the uterine embolization, would there be any reason, or would I be in a different category when a doctor goes to evaluate you because my ovaries were affected by uterine embolization?
No.
Or maybe not?
No, not at all.
So they could go ahead and do a cost or risk benefit about whether I should be keeping the ovary or having them removed along.
Right, but I want to make sure that you know that the only reason to have a hysterectomy at this point is if you're still being bothered by your fibroids, or if for some reason new symptoms developed or new fibroids developed. I think just the fact that they're there is not necessarily an indication for hysterectomy.
Right. One of my concerns is that I do have some damage that's not related to that in my spinal column, in every part of my spinal column, as a matter of fact. And there is some question like whether that fact that I still have a uterus and the fibroids are calcified, whether they were naturally or from the uterine embolization, might be affecting nerves in that area or, you know, my function or pain level. So that was kind of where I was coming from that. But you did answer the question about years down the line, is there anything, you know, that people experience differently? And you're saying, no, people don't really experience okay. anything differently who
That's
have
right.
that. Thank you so much,
and
Dr.
And thank you for the call. Appreciate
right.
it. Yeah. Okay. What we do is we leave it up there until we're done hanging up. Okay. Let's go to Mary in Saratoga Springs. Mary, you're on.
Oh, hi, Alan. Thank you. My question is about dental x-rays. I've been refusing them for 5 years, but now the dentist thinks he should take what is termed a whole head set of x-rays. What about the radiation in that?
Well, I mean, like we've been talking about, the radiation is something to always consider, but at some point, your dentist or any doctor for that matter may feel that the information they can gain from those x-rays is worth the small incremental risk that those x-rays may give to you. So I do not think that there's too much radiation in those set of x-rays. There's only too much radiation if you're having them very frequently and on a regular basis.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. And we'll go to Walt in Colony. Okay, Walt, you're on.
Okay. Doctor, I am currently dealing with some bulging and discs and pinched nerves and so on and so forth. When I first went to my primary about this, he immediately sent me for an MRI and had me get a copy of the disc from the place where I had the MRI. When I went to the neurosurgeon practice, the doctor put the disc into her laptop and just said, oh, that won't open. All right, I'll send you for some x-rays. So I had three x-rays there in the office. Now, I know the MRI is not radiation, so I'm not concerned about that. I'm also having steroid shots, which requires an x-ray for the doctor to be sure he's putting the shot in the right place. I had 30-odd years ago, I had radiation treatment for a hyperactive thyroid. I don't get dental x-rays, you know, precisely because of all of that. But I'm wondering, you know, well, first of all, I was really ticked thinking about the health court cost of taking that MRI and then not using it. And not even investigating, you know, from another computer or something.
Okay, hey, Walt.
Also,
hey, Walt, let's do this one at a time. If
all right,
we can.
Well, anyway, so the point is, you know, I've had considerable exposure to x-rays. And I'm wondering, you know, if it's time to say something to the doctor about, whoa, let's do an MRI that you can open and cut out using all these x-rays.
Now, Walt makes a very good point. I had the same thing happen to me. The MRI that was taken was not compatible with the screen that the doctor was using. I wonder about that. How does that work?
It's incredibly frustrating. Imagine being in a place like Albany Med where we sure. are, and we have patients that are referred to Albany Med from every hospital in the region.
Sure.
Frequently, they come with CDs
sure.
from outside hospitals, and we're asked to interpret those exams. Sometimes we can open them. Sometimes we can't.
Why not?
Well, it's just it depends on how they prepare the CD. There are some CDs that are prepared for looking on a regular computer and some CDs that are prepared for opening it up on a formal imaging interpretation center. Mm-hmm. So some of it could just be how they prepared the CD. But I do want to take a step back to one of Walt's questions, because even though your doctor couldn't open the MRI, what I can assure you is that there was a report there. So a radiologist somewhere probably read that MRI. So even though the doctor admirably wanted to take a look at those images, the bottom line is that he or she knew what those images showed, because there was a report attached to it. And even if they couldn't open the CD on one computer, it probably would have opened on another computer, or they could have requested another CD.
Which yeah. is exactly, Walt, what
my
I did.
My point.
Which is, no, exactly what I did. I went back to them and said, my doctor says that this won't open up. They said, okay. They gave me another one.
Try this one. And it worked, right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what they said to me was, you know, go down the hall and get, you know, get these three x-rays now. I mean, what am I supposed to say?
Yeah.
No.
But Walt raised a very interesting point. Is there anything coming, doctor, in which you can get some kind of a needle in you, in which they're going to tell you exactly what your accumulated radiological risk has been? Is that coming? Is there something like that?
I don't think there's going to be a needle they can put in you, but what some places are starting to offer is a card that at least will tell you what your radiation exposure is for a particular exam, and patients can be responsible for keeping their own records as to what exposure they've had.
Yeah, but what Walt wants to know is, he's had all of this, is there any way that this can, what his risk, that his risk can be judged based on the accumulation?
Tough radiation. To know, because it's so variable, and I'm not trying to avoid answering the question, but ultimately what it depends is how far apart the x-rays were delivered, exactly to what part of the body the x-rays were delivered to, because if you had an x-ray, one x-ray of every part of your body, it's different than getting 20 x-rays of your spine. So it's just different.
And Walt, we thank you. We got a hard break here. We got to go. Thanks a lot.
All right. All right. Thanks, Alan.
Yeah, right. 1-800-348-2551. Two free phones. When we come back, Lisa and Rochelle and Teresa will be there for you. Okay, take it away, Professor.
Support for WAMC comes from Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center, Poughkeepsie, offering a graduate program in social work and graduate and undergraduate programs in nursing. Adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley. Identity Eyewear Albany, customized eyewear fittings, European frame lines, and more. Identity Eyewear, it's what sets you apart. EYEDentityEyewear.net. And HMT at the Spa Little Theater, presenting the 39 Steps, weekends February 8th through 24th in the Saratoga Spa State Park, homemadetheater.org.
We are here with Dr. Siskin, a Mount Sinai Medical School graduate. Okay, let's go to, and the chair of the department at Albany Med, let's go to Lisa in Albany. Lisa, you're on.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. My question is regarding uterine fibroids and arterial embolization. I wanted to find out these polyvinyl pellets that are used in the treatment. Are there any allergic reactions that you've seen?
No, none have been reported. They're polyvinyl alcohol, or PVA, which is really a form of plastic in some ways. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But what we know is that they've been used for this type of purpose since the early 1970s. So medicine in general has over 40 years of experience with these particles, per se, for the use of embolizing arteries or blocking flow in arteries. And we just have not seen allergic reactions or other problems related specifically to those particles.
Lisa.
Yeah. So as with the plastic, you know, like plastic bottles, where you see leaching of some of these toxins from the plastics when they're exposed to high heat, being that the body is 98 degrees, would that have any impact?
You know, I understand where the question's coming from, but all I can do is kind of go back to that 40 plus years of experience, saying we just haven't seen those problems come up.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. And let's go to Rochelle in Ashfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Rochelle.
Hello. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a strange question. I don't know whether you addressed this before. I just turned on the radio. When I was a baby, born in 1951, I had birthmarks that I was told were radiated when I was an infant. And I have, like, you know, these scars left from whatever they did to me. And I've always been curious about it. And do you know anything about that? I had one on my head and I had one on my bum.
You know, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but it's just not something that I do or anyone else in my department does as part of their practice. But certainly goes back to saying that any radiation exposure that you get should be done in moderation. It doesn't sound like you've had a problem from that radiation exposure or have needed repeated exposures since that initial procedure. So I wouldn't worry too much about it.
Yeah, but her question still is, Doc, how do you get one of those if it's indeed from radiation? I think that's what she said, isn't it, Rochelle?
Well, I was just curious about the whole thing. I had never heard of that. That they were getting rid of birthmarks with.
Oh, getting rid of birthmarks.
Yeah, they were like, radiated them off of me.
Well, Rochelle, before the doctor answers, let me tell you, I've read a little bit about some of this stuff. When X-ray was invented, they used it for everything. I mean, they really used it for a lot of things, which were inappropriate at the time. Isn't that right, Doctor?
Want to hear something interesting?
Yeah.
When it was first invented. They used to take it to fairs and carnivals.
Yeah.
And people would go and get x-ray photos of themselves, like just a camera.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. And I mean, I've heard of a lot of really weird stories, some of which you really don't want to hear on the air.
Well, I guess I'm here, so I guess I didn't get, you know, ruined by it, but I've just always imagined a little tiny baby and that happening, and I just wondered whether it was something that I needed to think about in my future or something. But.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Rochelle, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Let's go to Teresa. Oh, no. Do we have to take a break? Have we taken a break? I don't owe you a break, do I? No. Okay. Let's go to, sorry about that, Teresa in Sharon Springs, New York. Go ahead, Sharon. Teresa.
Teresa. Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. And about 20 years ago, I went through chemo and then radiation from my chin down to my sternum. I had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I had about 10 years ago, or maybe 8 years ago, I had to have surgery to fuse some vertebrae in my neck. And when they were doing the MRIs, they said that there was low signal to those vertebrae. I have two questions. I'm wondering, and you could see where the radiation had whitened my vertebrae. And I was also curious if that the radiation had caused some kind of weakening in my vertebrae that I'd had to have this surgery to, because I was losing feeling in hands and feet. So I never really asked the question of the doctors I was seeing at the time, but I'm curious if there's any connection.
Okay, here we go.
Well, I mean, sure. First of all, I'm glad to hear that you're doing well. But second of all, certainly when you have the higher dose radiation, which is different than what we've been talking about with x-rays and CAT scans, there's always a risk of some side effects from that. And certainly some changes can occur in bones as a result of being exposed to radiation. However, I think what you describe is definitely not that common. And it's far more likely that maybe you've just developed some typical arthritic changes or degenerative changes in the spine that could be causing the symptoms that you have.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good to know. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Teresa. Okay. Let's go to Mary in Wilbraham. Okay, Mary, you're on.
Hi. I have a couple quick questions. I'm a cancer patient, so I've had some exposure over the years. And I have two quick questions. The first one is hopefully a quick no. As far as nuclear scans, my PET scans and VQ scans, is that the same type of radiation or is that non-damaging?
Well, both of those scans are actually different. The PET scan these days, and presuming this is recently, PET scans are actually merged these days with CAT scans. So great technology that you have a PET scan involves the injection of something into your body, which tumors tend to take up. And the CAT scan helps us detect where that stuff finds itself in the body. So there's still radiation associated with the CAT scan portion of the PET scan. In terms of all nuclear scans, yes, there still is radiation associated with nuclear scans, but it really is in line with the things that I've talked about already so far.
I'm sorry, what's a nuclear scan?
There are, in general, what nuclear scans do is they take advantage of different materials that are injected in the body to identify problems in the body. So we can change the atomic structure of an element injected in the body and see it end up in certain parts of the body.
Ah. So, and the last question, because a lot of people are asking it, I know they're out there wanting to get in and ask the following question, which is, quite frequently you get an MRI and they offer it to you with or without dye. Mm-hmm. You know, the docs that I saw down at Special Surgery in New York took a look and they said, you don't need the dye. When do you use dye?
The dye is going to take advantage of the fact that when dye goes to a certain structure in the body, we can tell more information about it on these scans. So sometimes if someone has, let's say, a bony problem in their body, let's say they have a problem with their knee or their shoulder or different bones, we really can tell what the problem is on an MRI without the use of IV dye. But if we're looking for tumors or other more sophisticated problems, the dye really helps differentiate normal tissue versus abnormal tissue and can help us make a diagnosis for you.
And if they do it without it, can they still go back and do it with it? In other words, so these guys are saying, oh, okay, in your case, we didn't need it.
Mm-hmm.
So they always had the option of going back.
You always have the option of doing it again. Yeah. But the thing is, you have to remember, is we always want to compare the images with and without the dye. So sometimes you have to make sure it's on the same MRI scanner. Yeah. There's just different nuances to that.
Mary, good question. Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to Maggie in Schenectady. Maggie, you're on.
Hello?
Hi, Maggie. You're on.
Hi. I'm calling with a thank you, kind of, to Dr. Siskin. I don't know if this is repetitive. I turned the radio on when someone was talking about uterine artery embolizations, I think.
Right. That's his specialty.
Okay. I know that from experience. And 10 or 12 years ago, after six gynecologists had recommended having my uterus out, he did an uterine artery embolization, and it was wonderful. And I'd just like to recommend it to anyone, because there are still people who haven't heard of it. And not only was he excellent at what he did, but he and his people were kind and caring. And a big thank you.
Well, Maggie, he's glowing. I just don't know if that's from the radiation or from your face.
Well, thanks for the kind words, Maggie. I'm so glad to hear you're doing well.
Thanks, Maggie.
Yes, thank you. Okay, bye.
Okay, and we'll go to Audrey in Schenectady. Audrey.
Hi. I'm calling about a friend of mine who had a hernia repair in early December, and it's gotten all screwed up. He's wound up having blood in his abdominal cavity three times now, and they had after the hernia repair, when he went back into the hospital, they had a radiologist from your Albany Med go in and take out the blood, and then he had a Jackson Pratt drain, and now the blood is come back for the third time, and I'm just wondering, based on what you do, if there is a leak somewhere from the hernia repair, is there a diagnostic tool to find that?
Okay, there's the question. Doc, your turn.
Sure, it's a great question. So a two-part answer. The first is a test like a CAT scan can really help with that, because typically what we do is we have people drink a form of dye for a CAT scan. And if the dye that you drink and it should be inside your intestines is seen outside of your intestines, then we know there's a leak somewhere, and that could really help us find it. In terms of what he had done or she had done, interventional radiology, which is what I do, typically takes advantage of imaging tests and allows us to, in some ways, treat the problems that we're diagnosing. So if there is a collection of fluid in the abdomen or some blood in the abdomen, we can go in and put a drain of sorts into that fluid to take it out of the body. But we all have to understand, as you eloquently pointed out, that still doesn't necessarily solve the problem. If there's a leak, then ultimately the leak has to be discovered and fixed, and that's what the diagnostic testing would be done for.
Okay, because he did have, in the beginning, a CAT scan with dye, and then he had an ultrasound this month, and it was an interventional radiologist that took the blood out the first time. But would it be a blood vessel? I have to be. If it's filling up with blood, a blood vessel that's leaking as opposed to the intestines, can that be discovered with what you're talking about?
Yeah, but the reality is that if he was bleeding a lot of blood, it would be probably a lot more significant of a problem if there was active bleeding going on inside the abdomen. So it's probably a combination of things, and some of the blood could just be a result of some irritation or inflammation that's been caused by the leak. But with that said, I think what I want you to take away about his particular condition is that sometimes these leaks are temperamental, and you can see them one day and not see them another day. So quite frequently, we find ourselves imaging people over and over again looking for a leak that's a little bit stubborn for us to find.
But hernia issues come up from time to time. People, you know, get the stuff done, and it just doesn't always work. Yes.
No, it's not a perfect procedure, and so what you hope is that the surgeon that you're dealing with is able to take care of the problems that could potentially arise from any procedure that's done.
Audrey, thank you very much.
Thanks. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Okay, and we'll go to Barbara in North Adams. Barbara, you're on, and we may be able to take one more question after this, and this is the last light that's on. So if you got one, here come five phones. Make the call 1-800-348-2551. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi, doctor. I had endometrial cancer 6 years ago, and I had a hysterectomy, chemotherapy, and radiation. And I'm well now, but I had radiation to the pelvic area, and I now am incontinent. Is there any way of, are those cells that were radiated, are those dead or non-functional, or is there any way of rehabilitating them?
Well,
I no longer see the radiologist. You know, it was a number of years ago, and I'm wondering what to do now.
You know, I don't know if I necessarily have all the information I would need to answer your question, but certainly radiation can cause some of these problems. But the other thing to remember is that you did have surgery, you did have cancer in your pelvis, and any one of those things can independently cause those problems. So the fact is that many of the cells treated with radiation may or may not be restored over time. So I think that's definitely a question to ask your radiation oncologist.
Barbara, okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, bye, Barbara.
Thank
bye,
you.
Barbara. Let's go to Joe in Beacon, New York. Joe, you're on.
Hey, Alan, Doc. I've had chronic kidney stones for a long time. I feel another one just coming on. I have some work where I'm going to be going out of the country, and I'm wondering, is there some way to get this thing zapped or, you know, taken out short of surgery? You know, short of passing it?
Well, there are definitely procedures that urologists offer the patients every day that can treat kidney stones. So I would definitely suggest that you speak to a urologist. And if you've had kidney stones, I'm sure you have one on speed dial. So I would definitely take advantage of that and talk to him about something that could be done if you're heading out of the country.
And what am I asking for exactly?
Well, I mean, you just want to know if there's something that they think can be done. Because, sure, there are quote-unquote zapping procedures. There are ways for urologists and radiologists to go in and actually physically take out the stones from the kidney. A lot of times that's not necessarily done unless the stones are so big that they're blocking the flow of urine or if they're just in a place that's causing you a lot of pain. But either way, I think it's a conversation worth having with the urologist to find that if there is some minimally invasive procedure that can be done before you head out of the country, if that's a real concern of yours.
Joe, we're going to let you go. Thank you very much for that. Let's go to Teresa in Pauling. Okay, Teresa, you're on. You'll probably be the last person. Go ahead.
It's Patricia.
Oh, so sorry.
That's okay.
Looked like Teresa to me.
I had radiation therapy after a breast lumpectomy. And a month after the treatments ended, I was diagnosed with radiation pneumonitis.
Mm-hmm. What's that, doctor?
Well, it means that the radiation affected the lungs itself and it caused an inflammation of the tissue in the lungs, making it potentially difficult to breathe or have other problems with the lungs.
Okay, Teresa, your question is?
How does that happen? Two doctors had indicated that the angles used should not have given me the pneumonitis condition. So I'm wondering how that happened.
Well, you know what? In some ways, it's obviously difficult for me to answer your question. First of all, it's not something I do on a regular basis in terms of treating cancers with radiation like that.
Uh-huh.
But certainly radiation pneumonitis, especially when you're treating something like breast cancer, is definitely a possible risk to that type of treatment. So it's, again, worth having another conversation with your radiation oncologist about that.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Teresa. Okay, we are so sorry. We're not going to be able to take Sonia's call from Lenox, Massachusetts. We encourage you to call the next time, and we thank everybody who called today because it's just great to hear from everybody. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. health-quest.org for locations. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Thank you so much to Dr. Gary Siskin for joining us today. I know how busy you are, Doctor, but I hope you'll come back and join us again.
Will do, Alan.
It's
nice meeting you.
Really great. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Thanks to Eric Krupke for answering the phones today. Our producer's Patrick Donges. I'm Alan Shartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.